Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Burrow sofas are built for the way you live. With thousands of possible configurations, their five-seating collections fit any decor, from classic mid-century style to sleek contemporary design. Burrow sofas are made to last and grow with you. You can add seats whenever and easily assemble your updated sofa with no tools needed. And free shipping always? That's just the cherry on top. Right now, save up to 50% during Burrow's spring sale at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Dr. Jan Effingstall, a counsellor in Melbourne, Australia, who specialises in working with people who hoard. Jan, how are you and how was Japan?
Amazing. And kawaii, which just means cute, and sugoi, which means amazing. So yeah, no, it was great. Cute and amazing. We had a ball.
Did you manage to moderate how much stationery you brought back home?
I was very proud that I invested in pieces that, you know, that I know I will have for a long time and that I can pass on as heirlooms.
Will you use them?
Yes, I'm trying very, very hard to use them. I don't know. I didn't need them. Let's just face facts. I did not need them. But I was very proud that I didn't buy any notebooks or any. I refused to buy those types of things. I only brought things that were, you know, that were special.
Last year, my saying for the year was it'll do, as a bid to temper my perfectionism. And this year, my saying is make do, because I am trying, because I've become aware through the podcast that hoarders, including me, don't use the stuff we have. And so I am proactively trying to use my stuff rather than just having it.
Yes. And I've got a little note up on my board next to me that says it's not useful if it's not used.
I like that.
And I'm like, that's ticking some boxes for me, because we do just keep things. We have it. It's the, I mean, we have that. What's that saying? It's the getting, not the having. But in hoarding, it's the getting and the having.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, that's why I asked if you would use your stationery because I suspected you would be a "it won't be perfect when I've used it" kind of person.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I made sure that I started using the things I bought straight away.
Yes.
Straight away. So there was none of that specialness spiral going on. I used, like, my husband encouraged me. I bought this gorgeous handmade canvas and leather bag, and I adore it. But of course, I was like, you know, fussing about it, going, "Oh, I don't want to ruin it." And he's like, "No, you need to use it while we're here. Use it straight away." And I did, and I'm so happy because now I don't feel bad about taking it up to the shops or doing, you know, just doing everyday things.
Whereas if it was still unused, then it would still be unused in 5 years because you definitely can't use it now.
No, because, well, there must be a reason why I haven't touched it for 5 years. It needs to remain perfect. Yeah. So I made sure that I did use all the things that I bought straight away, and I'm feeling good about that.
Good.
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
So today we are talking about insight. Now, I resisted this as a topic for ages because people who lack insight into their hoarding will, by definition, not be listening. But the people around them might be, so I think it could be worth a deep dive. Plus, I realised that, like every single topic we talk about, there are likely to be degrees of insight. It's not necessarily an all or nothing situation. So you often hear people say that people who hoard don't have insight into it as a very blanket statement. And I don't think that's necessarily true. But Jan, how common is it, first of all, for a person to have a lack of insight into their own hoarding?
Once again, an excellent question. Nothing less than I would expect, I must say. But my answer is that we're not really sure how common a lack of insight into a person's hoarding is because it depends on who we ask, when we ask them, and what we ask. So 55 to 70% of people have poor or no insight if we ask loved ones. If we ask self-identified people who hoard, we find only 10% have poor insight and 3% have absent insight.
But they're so, self-identified people who hoard.
It's like, how can there be 3% who have absent insight? It's like, wow. My gut tells me that it's pretty rare for someone to be completely convinced that their hoarding behaviours and beliefs are not problematic. But I will admit that this is something that I think I discussed at length in my thesis, or at least I noted at the time that there was not a satisfactory, valid and reliable measure of insight in hoarding. And that's something that really needs to be addressed. And I'm glad that we're doing this topic tonight because there is a lot of grey areas and a lot of inconsistencies and definitely not enough research.
So there are different definitions of the word insight used in the studies I read. In particular, two that came up were anosognosia and overvalued ideation. Could you explain what those are so that we need to know what we mean when we're talking about insight?
Yeah, exactly. So anosognosia refers to the lack of awareness of the severity of a problem. So it's the most straightforward kind of definition of insight. It's a person's capacity to understand the nature, significance, and severity of illness. It's the sort of way insight is defined in neurocognitive disorders like schizophrenia, dementia, Alzheimer's, and other disorders that impact the frontal lobe of the brain. Because insight can actually be considered an executive function in and of itself.
Okay.
So if there's a lack of insight, then there's an impairment of executive function. So anosognosia is really what we see when people just don't believe that they have an illness at all. They can't recognize it in any way. Overvalued ideation refers to the strength and rigidity of a person's thinking. So it's not whether the person recognizes the symptoms are problematic. Chances are they probably recognize, oh, I've got a problem. But their thoughts are so rigidly fixed. So in hoarding, the excessive and unreasonable beliefs are about the value of possessions and the high level of personal responsibility as well that a person feels they have for the well-being of objects. So it's a couple of things there. There's the value of possessions, but also it's me that will make sure that this possession finds its way to the right person, or is disposed of in the correct way, or is loved in a way that I think it should. So overvalued ideation isn't about that recognition of the negative consequences. It's about that strength and inflexibility of beliefs, and that can be mild to delusional, supposedly. So a person recognizes the that the consequences of their behavior are problematic, but they're so rigid in their beliefs about how valuable their stuff is, you know, either monetarily, emotionally, historically, aesthetically, that they're unable to take action to reduce the clutter. So in their mind, there's no solution.
Yeah.
Putting stuff into the bin, it can't be done. Not shouldn't be done, but it can't be done. It's impossible. And not rescuing objects that could be useful isn't possible either. You know, that must happen. There's no other answer to me. And the other aspect or type, I guess, of insight is defensiveness or defensive denial, which can appear to be low insight. So those are kind of the three that is discussed in a lot of the early literature around insight for hoarding, and it's kind of stems from the research around schizophrenia and other types of psychosis or delusional disorders. It's kind of been used as a conceptualization of insight for hoarding.
That's really interesting, and I think the questions we're going on to cover those in different ways, don't they? So,
yeah.
Is it possible for a person to have insight into some aspects of their hoarding problem but not others? For instance, I always knew I was very messy. I always knew it was socially unacceptable because I was embarrassed by the state of my place. But for a long time, I didn't think I had too much stuff, just that I wasn't organized enough. Or there might be people who acknowledge they've got a bit of a problem, but not the degree to which their life is impaired. How does insight work in that kind of grey area?
Yeah, because it is so true that often we think it's about not having enough storage. You know, there's not, I'm sure I could wrangle this stuff
if I had a system and if I had enough shelves and boxes, it would be fine.
It would be fine. There's and I think the thing to understand is that insight isn't an all or nothing proposition. It's not static either. And yeah. it's like a dynamic kind of thing. And context can also be very important. In one situation or in one part of the house, you can see very clearly where the problems lie. But in other parts of the house or with another person in another, in another space, you feel very differently about things.
Yeah.
Previously it was kind of considered dichotomous, you know, it's either present or absent. But more recently it's kind of been viewed as a dimensional kind of concept with several levels and types of awareness. Like clinical insight, which is one's awareness of presence of a mental disorder or illness, is very similar to that anosognosia. And cognitive insight, one's ability to challenge conclusions and flexibly alter your beliefs in response to new information and feedback, is very much the overvalued ideation kind of concept, right? And there's also the understanding of how the disorder impacts functioning. So there's these kind of three parts to it. It has been suggested that these three aspects of insight are independent of each other. So a person may have high awareness of their disorder and how that relates to their functional deficits, but at the same time be unable to see the irrationality of their beliefs, which is so familiar to me.
Yeah.
I can really understand that. You cognitively, you get it. You know, clinically, you know you have a disorder of decision making and attachment, but you just can't flexibly change or adapt to the information that's flowing in, and you can't recognize it's too much. It just doesn't seem to compute.
Something I'm finding with myself lately is I can look at, say, my crockery cupboard, and I can look and go, I have far too many bowls and plates, and I know that is the case. But when I come to picking them up individually, they're suddenly all important. When I look as a whole, that's ridiculous. I live on my own. I don't need 12 dinner plates and 18 bowls. But then each one, oh, well, I've got to keep that because.
Exactly. It's something about that switching from the macro to the micro that really, that often people I work with struggle. They can see it on this macro level. I know I've got too much. But the second they focus in on the individual, all of those thoughts pop up and they can't say, oh, come on.
Yeah. It's really odd. I can almost feel the switch happening these days. Like, this is far too many T-shirts, but then on an individual basis, every T-shirt is, you know, it's
has a story.
Yeah.
It has a story.
And the other thing, when you were talking, I was thinking about, because there's a stereotype, isn't there, that you'll get somebody who crawls through tunnels in their newspapers and they say, I don't know what you're talking about, there's no problem here. And that's the kind of stereotype that people have about hoarding and insight. And that's one I've never, I'm sure it happens, but it's not one I recognize in myself or in any of the people I talk to. But thinking of it in degrees of, like you say, maybe you have insight that there's a problem, but not that you've got too much stuff, or you've got insight that you've got too much stuff, but not that there's this other stuff going on. It's all, there are not only degrees, but degrees on several, what's the word?
Variable. It's like, it's a spectrum, but it's on various different variables. So everybody kind of has a different.
Yeah.
Profile.
Yeah, like when you do that quiz to find out where your politics are, and it's not just left to right, it's also liberal to authoritarian, is it? And you're somewhere on a vast graph rather than
exactly
a 0 to 100 situation.
Yeah, exactly. And that is what makes it so difficult, or not difficult, but that's why it makes it so important. Not to just look at cookie cutter kind of treatments or cookie cutter kind of average hoarder kind of conversations, because no one's the same. No one hoards the same. No one has the same combination of comorbidity or trauma or life experiences. And that is reflected in insight as well.
Whenever I read a study, whenever I hear from a listener, whenever I chat to you, there are always, like we were talking before the call about how some people value the things they own very highly and monetary values. And I'm kind of these days able to say that's not something that I've got, but I know it's something that affects other people. And that it's not, there isn't a hoarder who represents the whole story. It's vast.
No, it is. And that's what, you know, kind of makes it so interesting to me. But it also makes it a complex thing to manage and to work on as an individual.
Definitely. So a study by Helena Drury and her colleagues that I will link to in the show notes was really interesting to me. I'm not going to read out the colleagues because there are about 38 of them.
So they're the usual they're the usual suspects. It's okay. All of those are the usuals. It's very incestuous, the Hornet community of researchers.
I'm so familiar with all these names these days. It's like, oh, there's Mary Doshu again. There's Jan again. There's Sharon again. There we are.
Exactly.
So first of all, this study points out that earlier studies that measured a lack of insight in people with hoarding disorder were studying people who had put themselves forward for the study. So by definition, could well have had more insight than a randomly selected group because they put themselves forward, so they presumably believe they have it. Or, you know, more insight than a group put forward because they were being required to have treatment. They put themselves forward because they already recognised they hoarded. Then Drury points out that there are other studies that have asked family members about the insight of their relatives who hoarded. And the difference in results, which you referred to earlier, was really stark. 10 to 14% of self-selected hoarders said they lacked insight, whereas at least half of relatives of hoarders said their relative lacked insight. So what did this study do differently and what did it find?
Okay, this was a really good study, actually. We know, of course, that there are X number of people who hoard that don't engage in research or seek help. We don't know how many those are, but we think there's quite a lot of them. And they're likely to have more severe symptoms because of poor insight or absent insight. So in this study, what the researchers cleverly did was found friends and family members of people who hoard. They called them informants. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I mean, I know that's the technical term in research, but it's kind of, you know.
Yeah, it's a bit uncomfortable, isn't it?
It makes me feel a little bit, yes, it's a bit off-putting. But asked them to encourage the hoarder in their lives to participate in the research. So it was kind of this way of creating a pair. So you've got family member or loved one and the person who hoards. They then compared informant responses for those who did get their hoarding loved one to participate with those informant responses from those who were unable to get buy-in from the actual hoarder, comparing both their severity of hoarding as well as their insight in both groups. So what they found was that those that didn't participate, those hoarders that didn't join in the fun, had more severe hoarding symptoms, as reported by their informants, so a second-hand report, and poorer insight. So 55% reporting poor or absent insight in those that didn't join in on the research. But there's a couple of limitations that stand out here with that study. It's a really clever little way of attempting to find out that information. But one is a sample size. There was only 27 pairs of family members and 40 relatives who likely met the criteria for hoarding because we didn't have people who were officially diagnosed. They used a measure, but it wasn't an official diagnosis. So this is modest. A modest sample size.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the modest. I thought that was, you know, that was lovely. And you can tell that they're British.
It's like on Bake Off when somebody presents something that looks awful and they call it rustic.
Exactly. A modest sample size. But this type of study is very difficult to recruit and it's a time-consuming exercise. So we have to look at it from that perspective as well. Secondly, they found a good overlap between the self ratings and the informant ratings of level of hoarding severity But the same can't really be said of insight ratings, can it? Because if everyone agrees to join the study, you know, if someone agrees to join the study, they're going to be given a higher level of insight by the informant, aren't they? Because, oh, well, they said they'd come along. So I can't really say they've got no insight. So, but it's a really neat way of looking at this really difficult to study part of the population. So I liked it a lot.
I did as well. I feel like it's, as you say, it's not like 100% perfect study, but it's drilling down and getting closer to the perfect study on insight.
Exactly. It's just, you know, it's just unfortunate that it would take a very long time to find those match, you know, those pairs.
Yeah.
But it is, it's good. Yeah, I'm impressed.
Do you want to be a de-hoarding darling? You can be now at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. If you love the podcast and want a bit extra, you can finally sign up to subscribe. Members will get an exclusive monthly post with an additional top tip, some podcast and music recommendations, and a personal update from me about how things are going. Find out the full details at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. So if somebody is considered to have a lack of insight into their hoarding, how do we know whether that's a genuine belief that there is absolutely no problem with how they live, or whether they are in denial? They feel fearful and hopeless, and it's just easier to say, this is fine, everything's fine, than it is to address that they are afraid and don't know what to do.
Oh, the insight specifier, there's actually an insight specifier included in the diagnosis of hoarding, suggesting kind of three levels of insight. So when you are diagnosed with hoarding disorder, you're taken through a number of questions, and then there's this additional with good insight, with poor insight, and with excessive acquisition is the other one of these little specifiers. So there's three levels. There's good or fair, poor or absent, delusional.
Yeah.
And the person being assessed is asked, to what extent do you think your saving behaviour, difficulty discarding, resulting clutter and excessive acquisition is problematic? Based on their answer, they're given a rating. Okay, so where the individual recognises that hoarding-related beliefs and behaviours are problematic, they're rated as having good or fair insight. If the individual, I shouldn't be laughing because I just, it's silly. But anyway, if the individual is mostly convinced that hoarding beliefs and behaviours are not problematic despite evidence to the contrary, they have poor insight. When the individual is completely convinced that hoarding-related beliefs and behaviours are not problematic despite evidence to the contrary, insight is absent and or they're delusional. So a psychologist is sitting in a consulting room with an individual. How can they tell if it's a genuine belief that nothing is wrong or something else? I mean, they've asked that simple question, to what extent do you think it's problematic? And then they make a decision and give them, put them into three categories. I mean, let's unpack, pardon the pun.
I mean, they might be like, I think it's fine, but it is problematic with my relationships. Where's that? Are they insightful because they see it's causing relationship problems, or are they not insightful because they personally think it's fine?
Exactly, exactly. It's like the psychology of this absent insight, it needs to be drilled down further. Our possessions play a significant role in our sense of identity. So, I mean, even a lack of possessions, like some minimalists out there, suggests something of our person's the other person's nature, doesn't it? Our values and our preferences. We know there is a significant positive relationship between hoarding severity and self-criticism and shame. We have only a couple of studies, but we have seen that in the research. It stands to reason that a person who hoards at severe levels would wish to preserve their self-concept to avoid shame and self-doubt. So they're going to strive to preserve the possessions they've collected as that extension of their persona. They're likely to avoid acknowledging the hoarding, even to themselves, chances are, which is often called clutter blindness.
I think I was definitely there for some time.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. You just get, it's almost like a dissociative response. It's that, I have to just kind of shut off the visual and just it's just not there. Or recognize the issue but deny it's a problem when confronted and keep others from discovering it by using avoidance strategies. So we see this when a person goes to extreme lengths to hide the hoarding by not answering the door, getting picked up around the corner, never inviting anyone in, meeting people at the, you know, at the coffee shop or at the pub. And some, if they have children, scare the kids to keep the secret. Don't tell anybody because you'll be taken from us or whatever. They recognize there is the problem. They understand that it's not normal and they could face censure, so they refuse to admit to a problem. So we know that there can be severe consequences to a person's freedom if they are exposed, and they may have no choice. You know, they may not be able to live as they want to, and that choice will be taken from them. So, you know, the fact that they're in the psychologist's office right now means that they've been discovered. A person who hoards may refuse to admit they have a problem when asked by an authority figure and be adamant about it, but in reality recognize they have difficulties due to the hoarding. I mean, recognition is not an admission of a problem. And defensiveness in the therapy room is evidence of, you know, the motivation to restore that personal freedom. You know, it's been the focus of intervention research for decades. When a person's freedom is threatened, they tend to deny and avoid admitting that there's a problem. Basically, when we feel threatened, we react defensively, don't we?
Yeah. Earlier you mentioned the phrase defensive denial. If somebody is on at you about the state of the place, I can totally see you going, "It is fine. Stop it. This is fine." When on some level, you know, it is not fine.
Exactly. I mean, we call this psychological reactance, which is just a fancy name for saying I won't be told what to do and I'll do what I want. Thank you very much. So what could be considered zero insight on the face of it is more likely to be an attempt, possibly unconsciously, often, to defend and protect the ego and preserve that sense of self-worth. Denial, head in the sand, shift blame to someone else, all of these types of defensiveness and denial come out. So poor insight or just really attempting to preserve a sense of self-worth is potentially what's going on in that situation.
Which takes us back to that spectrum with many variables.
Exactly.
So I get the impression, as we've touched on earlier, from things I read and hear, that many people think that the vast majority of hoarders think the way they live is completely and absolutely fine. Whereas in my own experience and what I hear from listeners, I don't think this degree of absolute denial is common. Mind you, if they're listeners, that's another self-selecting sample issue. What is your impression of the proportion of hoarders who have zero concerns or awareness of the problem with of problems with the way they live?
This is actually a question that's been approached by researchers by looking at the profile of those who come to the attention of public housing and other community services because of their severe hoarding. So a recent study conducted by Sheila Woody's lab out of British Columbia, go Canadians, compared a large sample, like 800-odd, hoarding research volunteers with those who came to the attention of the community services due to significant hoarding behaviours.
Interesting.
Which is really worthwhile. Basically, they want to know, other people we're studying in these research or these research volunteers, how close are they to those that come to the attention of community services? So they found that the community samples were older, more likely to be males, lower socioeconomic status, had a lot more clutter, more squalor and fire hazards, and 40 to 60% had poor or absent insight. So these are the types, this is kind of the profile of those in comparison to the research volunteers who are usually females, you know, mid socioeconomic status, very rarely squalor, etc. In terms of what I've gleaned from purely anecdotal evidence, because there's so little any real scientific evidence to go on, is that what you're interested in? What I think,
yeah,
is going on. So I think the people who see absolutely no problem with their hoarding behaviours and resulting clutter are likely to have, you know, close relatives who hoard. They probably began hoarding in their adolescence and have suffered from significant interpersonal trauma, if what I've come across is any guide. Squalor is more likely to be present because the hoarding is likely to be severe. It's been going on since they were quite young, so they're likely to be unable to keep their environment clean. I think the other thing is neurocognitive damage that's impacting their insight is highly likely. As I said before, insight is considered an executive function. So dementia, traumatic or acquired brain injuries, interpersonal trauma all affect the frontal lobe, the seat of decision-making and higher order cognitions. So I would say those that just believe they don't have any problem just haven't got the capacity to comprehend that they do. They're also, again, in my opinion, likely to suffer from a comorbid debilitating psychological disorder, possibly a personality or schizoaffective disorder. They'll probably be a highly complex case with so many factors contributing to their inability to recognize the problem. I really do think it's a very, very small group of people who really have no concept that they have a disorder.
I tend to agree. Yeah.
Yeah, there is likely to be some sort of frontal lobe damage.
I do sometimes wonder if I got dementia, would I be constantly surprised at the mess?
Do you know someone told a researcher told me that they had found someone who had dementia forgot to hoard.
I knew someone who had ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, and forgot that she smoked. So she just stopped smoking because why would she smoke?
Why would she smoke? Because the memory disappeared. It's interesting, you know. I mean, it is very, I mean, that is fascinating to me. Like, I want to know more because that might give me an answer to what's happening.
Would I always be going, where's all this mess come from? Or would this be completely normal? I don't know.
Yeah. Or would it just fade into the background and you just step around it, which we often do as it is.
And hopefully when I'm of an age when I might get dementia, I won't be living like this. So
No. That's what we're attempting to face right now, aren't we?
Yeah. So in the studies I read about hoarding and insight, one theme that kept coming up was that a lack of insight impedes treatment. Mm. I know there was a Randy Frost, speaking of names that come up all the time in research, I know there was a Randy Frost paper that recommended adapting CBT according to a person's insight. So how would that work? And are there other ways therapy can be made more successful for somebody who lacks insight, either totally or to some degree, which from what we've both said is, you know, it's more likely to be a degree of it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, firstly, I'll say that if a therapist is just using a textbook and following along chapter to chapter, they're not likely to be successful helping anyone with any disorder. So we should, as therapists, be tailoring our approach to take into account, you know, the spectrum of symptoms using a humanistic approach. I mean, the client is always in control and you work with what, you know, the landscape or the profile that is put in front of you. I think what's being suggested in a delicate way is intimating that the hoarding treatment is a traditional kind of CBT intervention, which relies primarily on cognitive reappraisal or restructuring to bring about change. And that does not appear to work for most hoarding clients when it comes to their stuff. So I think what they're attempting to say here is, look at challenging, you know, if you try to challenge the person's reasons for saving on rational grounds, that's unlikely to work. And I've mentioned the egosyntonic nature of hoarding, which means the drive behind the behaviour is considered congruent with their values. So it's considered purposeful and right, in inverted commas. So attempting to get a person to challenge those thoughts on a rational, you know, on a rational basis is likely to lead to disengagement from therapy. And that, I think, is what was occurring in a lot of these studies where they were using the, you know, kind of the textbook approach of going chapter to chapter through the various parts of the hoarding CBT. So if we encourage diffusion, you know, from thoughts as we've discussed before, so rather than challenging them and berating our mind for these involuntary brain farts or whatever we want to call them, we accept that they're just words, not facts, that we don't, you know, we don't have to believe them or do what they tell us. So rather than berating our brains, we just, that's okay, I'm glad you're there, but I'll come back to you later and we'll talk.
Yeah.
Not have a full-on fight. And I think the experimental approach is also helpful. Like using a curious approach when someone, you know, often people don't believe that they'll be able to let go of something and feel completely fine after 7 minutes, because that's kind of the average. But without testing it, how do they know?
The aspect of CBT that was all about treating it as an experiment was honestly life-changing for me. It was the only way I could try anything. It was honestly life-changing. Just the idea of, okay, your goal is to take 2 bags out, but this isn't a pass or a fail. It's an experiment that will either work or it won't. And if it doesn't, we'll adapt it. And honestly, it freed me up so much.
That is so insightful, because I think that whole, I'm gathering information.
Yeah.
I'm going to learn more about how I approach it. I'm going to come away from this with something, not nothing. Because we often, when we don't achieve our goal, it's like, well,
I am a failure. Yeah.
What did I bother for? I'm a failure. That wasn't worth it. But if you're there, I'm going to check it out, see what happens. And I'm going to come out of it with more information than when I came into it, and I can then adapt how I'm going to behave in the future. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And it will work or it won't. Not I am okay or I am not.
I'm not okay. Exactly. Because the same thing is not going to work for everybody.
No.
You know, something that you read in a book is not necessarily going to be perfect for you, but parts of it might be.
Or something that works for me now might not have worked this time last year and might not work next year.
Exactly. There might be some different variable that's been thrown into the mix, like maybe you're not as well as you were last year, or you're feeling better this year. So we've got to be gentle with ourselves and have that compassion. And using that experimental approach, you know, we want people to be independent thinkers, and then we expect them to do what we tell them without question or evidence. It's like, what's that about? I mean, how does that work? You know, and it goes both ways. Like, both therapists and clients kind of need to experience to know. So we're all in it together. We're in the soup together. We're working these things out. I don't know everything. about you or even myself. You don't know everything about me or yourself. So it goes both ways. And I do think that experimental approach and being curious, I know you guys get sick of me banging on about it, but curiosity is just central. It's central to flexibility. It's central to psychological health. I just think curiosity is an awesome concept.
I see it very much holding hands with experimenting. Mm. It's a kind of let's see what happens if.
Mm. And the playful, a little bit of playfulness.
Yeah.
You know, just that little bit of kind of coming at it from, you know, not coming at it from a rigid kind of judgmental perspective. It's have a play.
Yeah.
I know that it may not work out perfectly, but let's see what comes up.
When I had the CBT for hoarding, I went into it not wanting to do it.
Mm.
And I went into it very skeptical because I was expecting, from what I knew about CBT, a very textbook. Like we would work our way through a process that she had predefined, and week three would be this and week four would be the other. And I was really pleasantly surprised that it was not that.
Mm.
And the aspects of it were immensely helpful to me. And I think had she been working through the workbook, it would have been a fraction of the help it actually was. I think the fact that it was very responsive to my situation is what made the difference between it being something I resentfully went through because I felt I had to, and it being something that, well, it wasn't a complete solution. I always say that it wasn't a complete solution, but I got tools and ideas from it that I still use 3 years on, like experimenting. Like when I go to do something and my brain says, no way, not stopping there, asking myself, what is that? what no way are we talking about? Is it an overwhelmed no way? Is it that's nostalgic stuff, I can't cope, no way? Is it I don't know where to start? No. Whereas I was just going, no way, and full stop. And leaving the room and things like that that I still use daily. But had it been this is week four, we're not talking about that this week, we're talking about, you know, I think there would have still been some value, but it wouldn't have been the same.
That's one of the difficulties with like manualized treatments that we want it to be nice and structured so we can test out the concepts with a group of people and then, you know, use that to validate our approach.
Because if everybody has exactly the same process, that's a lot easier to say this works or this doesn't work. Whereas if it's very personalized, it's harder to measure.
Exactly. And one of the things I remember learning, and I can't remember exactly the percentage, I feel like it's 30%, but 30% of change from one-on-one counselling comes from the therapeutic relationship. So it's like just the fact that this person is in tune with you and is listening and is there for you is enough on its own to bring about a certain amount of change. So, yeah, it's so much easier when it's a manualized treatment, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. But reality is just, you know, life is not like that at all. It's nuanced.
So if somebody is supporting a hoarder who does lack insight to some degree, and as we both always say, you're not obliged to help hoarders who don't want help or who aren't receptive to help. You're also absolutely not obliged to help hoarders if you have been negatively affected by their hoard, if you grew up in the hoard, for instance. But with those disclaimers aside, if somebody's supporting a hoarder who lacks insight, what can they do? Should they try to challenge that person's perception of their living situation?
Thank you for the caveats, because, yes, we do not support the family, help their hoarding family members. You can't spend your adult life trying to fix those who hurt you. But no. The unfortunate reality is, if a person is not willing or able to accept that they have a serious mental illness, basically, you are the problem in this scenario, not them. You're the one with the problem. They're fine as they are. There's a really great book that's been used by hoarding researchers who promote the harm reduction approach to help people who hoard. It's called I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help, How to Help Someone with Mental Illness Accept Treatment by Dr. Xavier Amador. It's a brilliant book. It's been around for about 20 years. It's a book that was written by a doctor desperate to help his brother, who was a schizophrenic with no insight, who refused to take his meds. Now, that kind of concept and that kind of situation can be how we find ourselves when we're, you know, when we're assisting someone with zero insight. So if the person is in complete denial about their interest, you know, their illness, confronting it head on is likely to be a disaster. Basically, with every dose of reality we give the person, we're faced with denials. You know, all we're doing is the denial dance, right? And then distance, anger, resentment's going to breed. So this doctor, from his own experience and research, has suggested a different approach. I'm going to say again, we don't advocate for family members to be the person to help loved ones who have been harmed by parental, spousal, sibling hoarding. But if you're a support person, a coach or therapist, I recommend what is known as the LEAP technique, which is something that Xavier has created. The book by Tompkin and colleagues called Digging Out details it as well. So if you want to go deep dive into how this relates to hoarding and harm reduction, that's your resource.
I will link to both of those books in the show notes.
Cool. Awesome. So it's been written, the Digging Out book has been written for loved ones and family members who are in a circumstance where elderly parents or family members have slowly lost control of the clutter. So it isn't for children of hoarders who've grown up in a hoard. It's for those that, you know, show up one Christmas and can't believe, you know, the change in the circumstances. So LEAP stands for Listen, Empathize, Agree, and Partner. So it's a process of creating an environment to communicate about the problem, rather than arguing, rather than looking at this denial dance. First of all, listen. So using your active listening skills, where you set aside your opinions, assumptions, and own needs. You're there to listen in order to learn about the person you're helping. So you're engaged and you're not waiting for your turn to speak. I remember learning that concept as a young psychologist and just going, yes, there are so many people that I converse with who are just waiting for the pause in the conversation to have, you know, without listening to what I've said.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things. Once you've listened, you show you understand their perspective by paraphrasing what you've heard. So letting the person know you might have got it wrong. You know, I may not have heard you correctly, but this is what I think you said. Don't argue, push back, just rephrase what you've heard in your own words. Ask questions to clarify, you know, never assume, and ask for facts, you know, the who, what, why, when, how questions. And then ask about the feelings and the thoughts the person's having. It's not an interrogation. You're asking questions in order to understand. Again, mind-blowing when you actually step back and think about a conversation. And then you offer feedback on what you've heard. So be honest and direct, but not brutal, using I statements. So, you know, what I'm...
I'm surprised to see how the place is. I'm sad to hear that you're struggling with this.
Exactly. And I'm, you know, I feel concerned that, you know, you can't sleep in your bed, or, you know, or make a cup of tea, whatever it might be. But using I statements, you're unsafe, you know. Yeah. we need to come up, and again, I reiterate, this is not when there's been abuse or, you know, neglect in your childhood and you're coming to your parents' home. It's if you're a therapist or you're a support person, a coach, come at it from this direction and you will begin your relationship in a much more open way. So next is empathize. So we show our empathy and compassion by reflective listening. Again.
Yeah, that sounds really hard.
Counseling 101. Yeah, exactly. That sounds really hard. That, it's similar to active listening. It's about reflecting how the loved one feels. Again, ask questions, summarize that you've understood what they've said so they feel heard and you reflect it back to them. Offer up guesses about what they might be feeling. You know, this has been going on for a while. I'm guessing you're feeling a little bit frustrated, or, you know, offer some praise when they're willing to discuss their thoughts and feelings with you. We very rarely say, you know, I really appreciate that you've told me that, or, you know, I'm really happy that you've let me know how you're feeling about blah, blah, blah. You've done really well. I know it's hard to express those concerns about your, you know, your living arrangements or whatever it might be. The next one is agree. At this point, you've been able to kind of ascertain some of the points that you agree and disagree with. So start with the points that you agree on. Don't argue or debate, you know. They might tell you that they feel like their soul is dying when they throw away something. This is your chance to paraphrase by demonstrating that you understand what they're saying. Throwing something in the bin is very hard for you. You know, I understand that. Ask permission to share your opinions, which I think is one of the things that really works well, because it's a respectful approach. I've observed, you know, what have I, is it okay if I give you my take on this, or this is what I, you know, this is how I see it. Even if they don't agree, at least you've remained kind of that caring and respectful kind of approach. Examine the advantages and disadvantages of accepting help, so that there's this mutual understanding of the pros and cons, but focus on the advantages of accepting help while clarifying the perceived disadvantages through reflective listening and demonstrating empathy. So focus in on that advantage. Try to kind of just...
Wouldn't it be amazing if you could use your cooker again?
Yeah, or have the family for Christmas. I know you love celebrating Christmas, and we used to have these amazing times. You know, let's help you get there. Wouldn't that be wonderful? The disadvantages. I hear that you are concerned about blah, blah, blah. So validate and demonstrate that you heard them, but don't argue against those disadvantages. Remember, don't agree with misunderstandings the person has about hoarding. This is one of the ones that I think is really important. Reflect back what you hear them asserting and then correct their narrative, but don't kind of slip into sarcasm or derision. You know, if they say, oh, well, I hoard because, you know, I lived through the Depression. It's okay. I understand that, you know, living through the Depression would be hard, but not everybody who lived through the Depression hoards. So, you know, that's not the underlying reason for your hoarding behaviours. And don't try scare tactics either, you know, just the facts. So don't go down the, well, they're going to come and take the house off you, or, you know, no exaggerations, just the straight facts. If you are not sure whether the fire department would suggest or that your house would be condemned, don't use that as a tactic, because that is going to backfire big time.
Yeah, but that's where defensive denial comes in.
Exactly. That's when you're going to get just the psychological reactance and you're going to shut down everything straight up. If you can't agree with the point of view the person holds, you can agree to disagree. So if they're adamant they're safe but have no running water or working toilet, you just need to say, look, I agree to disagree with you on that point. But there's no argument. It's just, okay, that's your opinion. This is mine. That's fine. And partner with the person. They're an adult. They have the right to live how they wish and refuse help until legal authorities decide otherwise. You know, if that's how they want to take their life forward, that's fine. If you are there in an assessment capacity and you know you'll need to report the hoarding if the situation doesn't change, you know, that partnering is kind of imperative. You've got a mutual goal of keeping the person safe in their home, so you can then create a plan to reduce all those negative things, risks of trips, falls, fire, illness, all those negative parts of the hoarding. You can kind of create a plan together. It's not going to run smoothly. It's not always going to be an easy ride. But at least if you've got that kind of dialogue started initially, it will, you know, you'll be able to mend any of the ruptures as you go along, because there will be ruptures and you'll be able to say, I'm sorry, I understand that I got frustrated the other day. You know, and bring it back to that empathetic and compassionate kind of conversation. But it's not easy. That's my long and the short of it is don't challenge their perspective and, try really hard to create a partnership.
Yeah, it's making me think of an older couple I know, and the husband has dementia. Mm. And the wife was very... She didn't know whether she should challenge his beliefs that were inaccurate or whether she should go along with them. If he thinks he's somewhere else or she's someone else, does she correct him or does she not? And she was very preoccupied with whether she was doing that right or not. To the point that I said, look, I'll find out for you, because she was very worried. And I found a book and read the book and passed it on to her. And basically it said, don't argue. Like, you're not in Wales, you're in England, or, you know, I'm not that person, I'm this person. But if it feels okay to gently kind of guide them to the reality, that's good. But don't feel you have to prove your point every time. Or, you know, it basically, if they're not distressed by whatever situation they think they're in, go with it. It's fine. Mm.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, my mum has Alzheimer's, and it is so difficult not to say, remember, remember this or remember that. And I catch myself when I do it, because really that's not helping. That's just, you know, well, she doesn't remember. So don't use that word. Just try something else. And someone else suggested the kind of yes and technique.
Yes.
You know, like
an improv.
Improv. Yeah, exactly. So play that little improv game and go the yes and.
Rather than no but, to be clear anyone who's not familiar with this. It's also useful, I find, in any difficult conversation. Yes, if there's somebody, I've been having conversations with somebody at work and we fundamentally differ on various things. Mm. And we were often... I certainly, and I'm sure this other person, would come out of meetings frustrated with each other. And I've been making such an effort when this person says something, rather than going, no, instead I go, yes, and it's honestly making for much smoother, more productive conversations. And that's without any kind of delusion, or it's just the ongoing difficult conversation, and it takes that challenge out of it. And so the other person doesn't get defensive, and it feels like a collaborative conversation then.
Exactly.
If mum thinks she's 60 and tells you about something and you can add to it rather than challenge it. Yes. Oh. And yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. I really have found it works super well, and you can be a bit playful with it too. Yeah, it's also good for your own brain to do the yes and.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's like, oh, rather than challenge that thought, just go, yes, and blah, 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 blah.
I find that in myself, it stops me being quite as rigid. In, you know, in the same way as I'm not challenging that other person, I'm also not feeling the need to dig my heels in. Instead, exactly. It is more like, yeah, you know, and I kind of move a bit. Mm. I'm a bit more flexible.
Exactly.
And that's good for me because I know that that's something I'm working on really hard.
Yeah, being more, being much more flexible psychologically. That's one of the things that Steve Hayes talks about, the word but, be out. I don't want to be out. So the use of and, you know, yeah. I'm this and this. I'm not this but something else, which I think is really, it's more accepting of who you are as a person, and it does help with that flexibility of your thoughts and your behavior. It flows down to behaviors, everything.
Yeah. So I believe that insight can grow over time. In my own experience, I'm now fully aware, for instance, that my problem is volume, not organization. But also, the more I learn and the more I practice getting rid of stuff, the more I challenge my weird thinking about stuff. So how can people help themselves and move themselves along that spectrum so they are closer to being more self-aware about the problems of hoarding?
Yeah, I think I've seen it too, where people over time, and it's usually through that exposure of practicing constantly, of getting rid of things, challenging their thoughts, exactly as you've done, that they start to feel a lot more aware of the clutter. So their clutter blindness drops and they're like, I'm really aware that there's spaces that I'm extremely happy with and I'm comfortable with, and it's just the right, you know, it's the Goldilocks of stuff for me. And then I look over here and I see areas for improvement. So there's that reduction in clutter blindness over time, and it is purely through practicing and challenging our thoughts. You know, when you think about it, I mean, a lot of people don't spend a great deal of time reflecting upon themselves and their thoughts. They don't even catch them as they fly past. Now, the more you can do that, the more likely you are to be able to understand yourself better. We might go through, you know, 50 years of our life and not really understand deep down who we are. So we're all on a journey. We're all trying to learn more about ourselves. And if we're not, then we're probably not the person listening to this podcast. But one of the easiest ways, if you're very kind of, you know, if this is, you're just starting to recognize that you have a problem and you're wanting to kind of get a sense of where you are in terms of, you know, the journey ahead, the easiest way is to take photographs of your space. Each room, focus on those functional areas like kitchen, bathroom, hallways, bedroom, living areas. Or you can use a mirror and look at the reflection of your space behind you. It's been found to kind of break that spell of clutter blindness in many cases.
Yeah, there is nothing quite like a photo to make you see that the space you thought wasn't so bad actually needs weeks of work.
I know. It is mind-blowing how much, and especially if you like go outside, go to the local park and sit down in an open space where you can rest your eyes on, you know, on nature and the beauty of it, and then you open up your phone and look at the pictures and you go, wow, is that really?
It's shocking. All like letting the electrician in a few weeks ago and suddenly seeing what he would see.
Yes.
Just awful.
Exactly. I mean, it is. The most confronting is to show someone else your space. You know, if you're working with a therapist but they haven't seen where you live, you're not going to get the best results without showing them, let's face it. I mean, hop on Zoom or FaceTime or something and show them around, or take a bunch of photos and email it to them. You know, spend a session talking about how you complete activities of daily living, how you shower, how you cook, how you, you know, they know that this is probably the most difficult thing you've probably ever done. But nothing changes if nothing changes. So we have to open ourselves up to that, you know, we fear that, like that sense of humiliation and that sense of shame. I mean, it's more than shame, it's humiliation that we've found out, you know, we got ourselves here, so there must be something fundamentally deeply wrong with us as people. But at the end of the day, this is, you know, your space is not a reflection of your worth. Your space is not a reflection of who you are. You are a reflection of who you are, and you can make these changes. But talking about and showing someone else is, you know, is so vulnerable. But it, as you know, it will open your eyes to what others are seeing. And you need to select someone that you trust, that you know has compassion and understanding, not the cranky old bat around the corner who, you know, has been nagging you to let her come around for a cuppa. I mean, she can sod off. You need someone who's really, you know, who's really compassionate, because you're not going to feel good if there's looks of shock and awe on their face. You need someone who's, you know, who's really understanding. But that's a way to move yourself along the spectrum, is exposing yourself to getting rid of things, challenging your thoughts, doing that over and over again, and looking at that experimental, you know, experimenting with your situation. And the yes and, leave you with yes and.
Yeah, because it can also add to, you might previously have gone, I want to keep this. But if you can even yes and that, I want to keep this and I don't have the space to, and it will be okay if I don't. So I can want to keep it and still get rid of it.
Brilliant. Beautiful. Magnificent.
That was pretty good for a spontaneous thought.
Magnificent. I mean, I'm in awe.
I think that's a good place to leave it.
It is.
Jan, if people want to find you online and they somehow haven't heard this question and answer 84 times before, where can they do so? Might it be on Twitter at @stuff_ology and on Instagram at @stuff_ology, or on Facebook at Stuffology Consulting, or on your website at stuffology.com.au, or they could email Jan at stuffology.com.au, and they should join your email list because it's excellent. Might they be the places they can find you?
Mic drop. Genius, yes.
I have transcribed that bit of the podcast, same
so
words,
many
so
times.
Many times.
So lovely to chat insight with you this evening.
Thank you very much.
See you soon. May we take a moment to reflect on the meaning of place and acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record and listen to this podcast today. I'm speaking on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and I acknowledge their connection to country, both land and sea, and culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I want to make sure I'm talking about the things you want to hear about. Are there things you wish the podcast covered or things you want to hear more of that I've already covered? You can let me know at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/topic.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So shout out this week to the Practically Happy with Miranda Anderson podcast. And a little bit of information here that I thought was potentially really valuable. Have a listen.
In his book, The Happiness Advantage, Sean Aker talks about a study where people who just think about watching their favorite movies actually raised their endorphin levels by 27%. So they're not watching the movie yet. They're just thinking about watching their favorite movie, and their happy hormones go up. He says anticipating future rewards can actually light up the pleasure centers in your brain as much or more as the actual reward will. This is one of the huge benefits of anticipation. It creates positive effects, physiological and emotional effects in the present, even before the thing that we want to do or are looking forward to happens in reality.
Because we all want to feel better, right? Maybe we need to make more of anticipating good things. Okay, thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast.
Answer is that we're not really sure how common a lack of insight into personal into a person's hoarding. My answer is admitting that there's a problem. Basically, when we feel threatened, we
the majority of hoarders think the way they love is live, not love.
Maybe that too.
The way we love is fine.
It's fine.
How many times am I going to read this sentence?
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critics pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Jen from the I Mom So Hard podcast.
Now listen, we don't want to brag, but yes, we are moms. We're average super moms.
Below average sometimes.
But we're not just moms.
Yeah, we don't want you to think that we're just moms. And we're not just supermodels either. We're not just pieces of meat.
That's
guys.
Right. We're not even close.
Yeah.
But we are comedians and we're also best friends.
We're also best-selling authors.
And television writers.
We created a viral web series.
With over 300 million views.
Okay,
what's
that's
up?
Bragging.
Who's bragging?
That is bragging
and we were
actually.
In our swimsuits again. Not supermodels.
We're also podcasters.
Are we podcasting right now?
Not right now, but we have been podcasting for 3 years. We're bringing laughs every Tuesday to women and moms everywhere.
And one dude who's a sophomore in college. His name's Greg. Whatever. He messaged us and made me feel cool.
So nice. Amazing. Please listen to the Am Mom So Hard podcast on Acast.
Woo!
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.